Welcome to the Digital Identity Digest, the audio companion to the blog at Spherical Cow Consulting. I'm Heather Flanagan, and every week I break down interesting topics in the field of digital identity, from credentials and standards to browser weirdness and policy twists. If you work with digital identity but don't have time to follow every specification or hype cycle, you're in the right place. Let's get into it. Hi there, and welcome back to a Digital Identity Digest. In today's episode, we're diving into a topic that's gotten a lot of attention lately, especially among those of us who spend our time thinking about infrastructure, standards, and users' rights. So this almost started as a rage blog, one of those blogs that gets written because the writer is so frustrated with something that they just have to let it out somewhere. In this case, the rage started in a Signal chat, and while I wasn't the person raging, it definitely still inspired a post. Now, on the surface, the post is about what's referred to as the quote-unquote phone home feature built into the specification for mobile driver's licenses. But dig a little bit deeper, and you're going to see it's about people and their approach to risk and how that actually plays out in standards development. So here's a setup. Mobile driver's licenses, or MDLs, are being rolled out across the U.S. and internationally. They're more than just the digital version of your government-issued ID. They are designed to be stored on your phone, and in theory, they're more convenient, more secure, and harder to fake than a physical card. But the devil is, as always, in the technical details. And one part of the ISO specification that defines how these MDLs work is a feature called Phone Home. That means when you present your credential to someone, say a bartender, a TSA agent, a pharmacist, the system verifying your ID can contact the issuer in real time to check its status. Now, that may or may not sound reasonable to you on the surface. Some people ask the question, if the license is revoked, expired, or flagged as risky, wouldn't you want the system to know about it immediately, right? But there's some catches here. I mean, for one thing, that same capability can be used to track when, where, and how often you show your ID, and the specification allows for that tracking on an individual level, and it can be silently turned on and off by the issuer. So in some implementations, the user might not even know that this tracking is happening. Now, this is not entirely a theoretical issue because this option is already embedded in the standards. And then how people choose to implement that matters a lot. Now, this is not a good versus evil situation. People come at this from different and very valid perspectives. And those perspectives are shaped by what they're responsible for or what they've experienced, whether that's protecting users from surveillance, protecting systems against fraud, or trying to build standards that can survive real-world deployment. And that's what I want to highlight in this episode, that there's more than one viewpoint here, and each viewpoint has its merits. So to make the trade-offs clear, I want to introduce you to three personas who each represent a legitimate but very different point of view. They're all fictitious. I made them up purely from talking to a lot of people over the years. So let's start with the pretend persona of Dr. Rhea Jamieson. Now, she's my idea of a privacy researcher who spent decades working with civil liberties groups and contributing to privacy-focused standards. Her position's pretty clear, that surveillance should never be the default, and if it must happen, make it visible, optional, and rare. She worries that when surveillance capabilities are built into technical infrastructure, even if they're not, quote unquote, turned on, they eventually will be, not because everyone's evil, but because once it's possible, the pressure to use it for convenience, for business, for politics, becomes very hard to resist. She points out that real-time verification, or phone home, lets issuers build a time-stamped log of everywhere an ID has been presented. And that's not just linkability, that's trackability right now in real time. And in some systems, that capability can be silently switched on without you ever knowing. So what does she suggest instead? Use cryptographic proofs, use time-limited credentials, build systems that don't make surveillance a default. She would acknowledge that there might be rare, legitimate reasons for real-time verification, potentially like border crossings. But if we're going to do this, it would have to be clearly disclosed, somewhat optional, and fully auditable by the user. So, in this imaginary person's world, Surveillance infrastructure rarely stays dormant. If we build systems that can track people invisibly, we have to assume somewhere, someone eventually will do it. Okay, so that's one perspective. Now let's go to another side of this story. And I'm going to talk about Marcus Lee, an imaginary vice president of fraud strategy for a global financial institution. Now, his world would be very different from Rhea's. Marcus is dealing with synthetic identity fraud, money laundering, and regulatory audits that don't go away just because the technology is elegant. From his perspective, static credentials, those that can't be updated or revoked in real time, are a liability. The position here is that you can't prevent fraud with stale data. Some level of real-time validation is necessary. What he's thinking about is controlled substances being dispensed to the wrong person, or a fraudster using a stolen digital ID to open a bank account before the real holder notices. In his world, real-time risk signals and revocation aren't nice-to-have things. They're baseline requirements for what he's got to do. His argument would be that, you know, enterprises can be bound by privacy policies, audits can help manage misuse, and trust doesn't mean removing safety nets. He doesn't want phone home to be the default everywhere, but he does want the option to use it where risk is high and liability is real. His warning, were he actually a person that existed, would be to say, if we strip out risk signals in the name of privacy, we'll end up rebuilding surveillance tools elsewhere with less transparency and even fewer guardrails. Alrighty then. But wait, there's more. I got one more persona here, and that would be the imaginary Priya Banerjee. Now, she's everything I imagined a good standards architect would be, someone who's participated in more than one standards development process and spends most of her time trying to bridge the gap between philosophy and practical deployment. Her job is hard because her take on this is that both sides are correct. So what she wants to do is design systems that make phone home capabilities visible, limited, and accountable. She agrees that invisible surveillance is unacceptable, but she also knows what happens when standards don't accommodate real-world use cases. Implementers will build workarounds. Sometimes those workarounds are worse for privacy than the original proposal. What Priya would want was a model where device-based verification is the default. If server retrieval is used, users are clearly notified, and that the credential app logs every network retrieval so users can see when, where, and how it happened. She believes standards should support both privacy-first use cases and high-risk environments without forcing everyone into a single box. In her view, the answer isn't to ban phone home or to silently embed it. It's to design for informed use with visible, enforceable boundaries. The takeaway here would be that designing for flexibility doesn't mean compromising values. It means making systems that work in the real world while ensuring that the user stays informed, in control, and protected. So where does that leave us? We've got three positions here. Rhea says if surveillance is possible, assume it will happen and design it out of your systems. Marcus says if real-time validation isn't possible, fraud will happen, so design it in. And Priya says if we're careful, we can do both, design for consent and adaptability. Each of these views is grounded in lived experience, not ideology, and that's why they all deserve a seat at the table, because there is no perfect answer here. And unfortunately, these aren't just technical decisions. They actually have values encoded into infrastructure. The systems we're building today are going to shape what's possible tomorrow, and if we don't think critically about the trade-offs now, we're going to be stuck living with whatever we do later on. So where would I take this? My ask for all of this would be as we build, standardize and deploy digital credentials, let's not treat these conversations as zero sum that only Rhea can win or only Marcus can win. Let's keep talking. Let's keep listening. And even though it may drive you a little bit crazy, hear each other out. Let's build systems that are worthy of the trust we're asking people to give us. And with that, thank you for listening to this episode of A Digital Identity Digest, and I will talk to you next time. And that's it for this week's episode of the Digital Identity Digest. If it helps make things a little clearer, or at least a little more interesting, share it with a friend or colleague and connect with me on LinkedIn at HL Flanagan. And if you enjoyed the show, do be sure to subscribe and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find the written full post at sphericalcowconsulting.com. Now stay curious, stay engaged, and let's get these conversations going.